This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Jared Hill, in for Steve Chiatakis. Today, let's head over to the Los Feliz area, virtually. We're going to go to Los Feliz's Next Door page. You know Next Door. It's America's top app for neighbors to share all the latest on package theft and free furniture. And on the Los Feliz Next Door, this summer, there was a request.
Please wear masks while walking.
That's an actor reading a real post by a woman named Meryl.
Please wear a mask while taking walks in the neighborhood. It's the least you can do. If you insist on being stupid, please move out of the way on the sidewalks. Thank you.
Well, that was all it took. Peace and harmony reigned.
Fair demands all around.
For one whole comment. After that, it pretty quickly went to hell.
In a city with 4 million people, it'd probably be prudent to just worry about yourself instead of trying to control everybody else, no?
She is worried about herself. That's why she's asking everyone to wear masks. Hope this helps.
Well, then I would assume that she would take the precautions like everybody else does when they're out walking around who may come across somebody who's not wearing a mask, and just take care of themselves.
It is odd to me that someone would insist on just take care of yourself when we could all get through this so much faster if we all just wore masks 100% of the time. Get over yourself and act like a good neighbor.
Hey, back at ya, smiley face. And I'm not disagreeing with this person. I don't agree with her execution. To insert my objectives on this blanket statement is just like her blanketing this statement on everybody, no?
You may be asking yourself, what play is this and how can I avoid it? In a way, you can't. Here in Los Feliz and in many other communities across the Southland, fighting about masks online is a new sport, with rules that seem to change constantly. Who needs one? Joggers? Is it babies? What about early in the morning? What about during full moons? What are the rules and what is this etiquette? Who's being rude and who's taking it all way too seriously? After Meryl kicked off this conversation, it ran on Nextdoor for more than 2 weeks. Lured in 70 participants, and sucked up untold hours probably better spent screaming into a pillow. And we've brought it to life.
Meryl is asking that we all do the epidemiologist recommended thing that will save lives. You're acting like an entitled brat. Big difference.
You're the only one here name-calling, so who's really the brat? You don't like my point of view? Keep scrolling. There's absolutely nothing you can say, especially
for today's show,
at this point,
we asked some actors to read a lightly edited transcript of the back and forth in the Next Door thread. Think of it like one of those true crime reenactments. We wanted to see how and why online conversations about mask wearing get so heated. Today on Greater LA, reporter Brandon R. Reynolds descends down, down, down into human psychology.
If people can't be convinced to wear masks by all the available data or by appealing to their sense of community, maybe they can be shamed.
You've heard this argument.
LOL. Okay. This kind of behavior has clearly been working for you so far, so you should just keep it going.
On the street, in the grocery store, online.
Yeah, it does seem to be working. The vast majority of our neighbors appear to agree with me, not you.
This one just happens to be on Nextdoor. It's caustic, convoluted, and as snipey and cliquish as a TV show about high school. I mean, it's got it all. Name-calling.
You're a truly awful person. Go hug your Trump doll. We're done, psycho.
Anatomical analogies.
If you were completely alone, it would be fine to let your nude tushy hang out.
Weird insults.
It causes me distress when you defend mean neighbors who viciously insult and attack people who are just trying to survive. Frowny face emoji. But I guess anal sphincters deserve kindness, too.
And desperate pleas.
I really want this mask thing to end. And ironically, the best way to do this is wear a f***ing mask! I mean that in the kindest way possible.
A large chunk of it is spent quibbling over confusing rules.
You're going to be running into other people. That's where the discrepancy lies.
I think the discrepancy lies in what it means to be near people. Some people see this as 6 feet, others see it as 600.
And that tends to result in a particular species of hostility that I can only describe as innovative.
When someone approaches us without attempting to keep a distance, we do it for them by holding out an umbrella in their direction so they are forced to stay away.
And naturally, there's also a whole thing about who is, who isn't, and who might be a Karen.
One of my good friends is named Karen and is the furthest from a Karen. She's having a rough go this year.
Real people named Karen shouldn't have to change their names. Rarely are these women behaving badly actually named Karen. Winky emoticon.
That last person's name was Karen, by the way. This threat has all the hissing and spitting of a typical mask fight, but without the political divide. This is the thing. Somehow they all pretty much agreed on the importance of wearing masks.
Once again, actually, read my comments. I clearly stated I wear a mask. I just don't care if others do not wear masks. Don't call anyone else ignorant or smug when both of those terms apply to you perfectly.
The insistence that people can take care of their own well-being is inherently flawed in this context. If you insist that you don't owe the rest of us protection from your potentially deadly respiratory droplets, why do the rest of us owe you any kindness or respect?
Though I wear a mask in public for myself and only myself, I despise the act of shaming others who choose not to do the same. You cannot control people. I also didn't appreciate people slinging mud.
It's a mask fight that isn't really about masks at all. But it still has all the charm of a scream fest between a MAGA hat-wearing, don't-tread-on-my-face conservative and a nanny-stating CDC homepage with breakfast liberal. What I wanted to know was, how have we gotten to the point where we're even arguing about agreeing about masks?
A bunch of people in this group are fascists, and they don't even realize that fact. It is sickening.
In 2020, there's no nit too small to pick. I talked to some of the, I don't know, gladiators in this spectacle. Tika Tabak was one of them. You heard her earlier. In real life, she doesn't have an English accent. She attracted a lot of ire, not because she objected to the mask proponents' arguments, but because she objected to their tone.
I think that if you feel very strongly about it and you want to actually go out onto the streets, I would strongly suggest kindly asking people to put on their masks and not say things like, stop being stupid.
And that's pretty representative of the two sides that formed up. It wasn't masks versus no masks. It was more wear masks versus I do wear masks, but don't use that tone of voice with me. And also just worry about yourself because people are going to do what people are going to do. So yeah, arguing about totally different things. Welcome to the internet.
In terms of your online conversations, this is one of the things that people often fail to do in these kinds of arguments is to try to understand the argument from the other person's point of view and to understand what are the values and beliefs and motivations that underlie the other point of view, and to try to connect with those, to try to connect your argument with those values.
That's Jonas Kaplan. He's a cognitive neuroscientist at USC's Brain and Creativity Institute. Jonas and his team study how beliefs form and if they can be influenced by messaging. He points out the first problem. If we're not connecting, we're all just talking at one another. He says another part of the problem is that we're sort of dumb about processing information.
We know that because it's so hard to correct misinformation and to change your mind once you have a belief in there, the first belief that you form and the first thing you hear has such an advantage over the later ones. This is something we saw go wrong with the whole mask situation, because first we were told that masks aren't going to help against this thing. And so people started forming beliefs around that, and then those beliefs become difficult to change. So there's a sense in which the first story wins.
That's called anchoring bias, where we put all this weight on whatever piece of information we hear first. I mean, we love not changing our minds. It's in our wiring.
You are required to wear a mask outside of your home. So it's interesting that we're even having this debate anymore. www.latimes.com.
The article you posted is dated May 14th. The link I posted is from May 15th, www.foxla.com.
Okay. Then everybody.
And we're swimming in a hot stew of conflicting information from health experts and officials and politicians, which we then lob at each other online. But of course, if every perspective can be represented, information becomes sort of useless.
It says by yourself. That means no other people. The article I posted makes it very clear, and that is from an LA paper, not Fox News.
The by yourself was in reference to not running with other people. She said to go to an area that's not crowded, not an area that is guaranteed to have no people. I'm not sure what Fox has to do with it.
And it may be that getting at the truth just doesn't matter, at least not as much as feelings. Strong emotion can basically bulldoze rational thought.
At any rate, we're going to have to agree to disagree. Your interpretation is different from mine.
That was my point to begin with.
Jonas Kaplan saw this in a brain imaging study he conducted about political beliefs. When those with the strongest emotional attachments to their beliefs were challenged by conflicting information, they just shut down.
They, you know, they had some kind of a negative feeling when they felt attacked, and they closed down and didn't take in the information.
Neither one of us is venting. We are presenting facts regarding the requirement for mask wearing. We're also not trying to convince anyone to wear a mask, because we don't have to. It's a city ordinance.
Right. So people jumped into that next door conversation because they had strong feelings about the subject, which is exactly what prevented them from being able to actually have the conversation they joined the conversation to have.
If that's your only motivation, why did you feel the need to call me unhinged?
I didn't call you unhinged. I said, you, sir, sound unhinged.
I absolutely did not sound unhinged. I was calm and rational the entire time. Here's the thing. You and I agree on 95% of the issue. I believe that people should be wearing masks. I believe in social distancing. I believe in being respectful of your neighbors. Where you and I disagree is if it is necessary to wear a mask when you are not near anyone.
On Next Door, as in the wild, intelligent and passionate people are intelligently and passionately not listening to one another anymore. That's why this thread is both so long and so devoid of purpose. It's the husk of a conversation with all the meaning and empathy sucked out. We've been reduced to scared kids, our emotional brains blaring so hard we can't hear anything else.
You're very interested in arguing with people you agree with 95%. Hope it's cathartic for you, LMAO.
After 16 days and 428 comments, it finally just petered out. I don't know, it cried itself to sleep. Whatever the case, nothing was resolved. There are some good points brought up on all sides and some terrible ones, but no minds seemed to change. The miracle of social media hadn't brought us all together. But 3 days later, a new conversation arose.
Wear a damn mask. And to the aging shirtless hippie who called me a, quote, sheep for wearing one because, quote, governors don't make laws. No more warnings or heated arguments. Next time, I will be naming and shaming.
This post got no response, which is maybe for the best. This is Brandon R. Reynolds for KCRW reporting on The Circle of Life.
Special thanks to all the actors reading those parts. They include Deborah Baker Jr., Paget Brewster, Mark Gagliardi, Georgia King, Hal Lubin, Annie Savage, Ben Schwartz, Amir Talai, Kristen Vangsness, Janet Varney, and Chris Williams. We really appreciate it. I have to tell you, when we taped the story, when I did my piece of the story, we actually did this yesterday afternoon, and I wanted to pronounce it Los Feliz, as I did. It's a Spanish word. It's named after a corporal, according to the LA Times, it's Corporal Vicente Feliz, and they named it after him. And Christian, our managing editor, our managing producer, who's here joining me in the studio, hello, Christian. We had a back and forth about this quite a bit, and I was frustrated because I was like, I don't want to say Feliz. I think that's like very whitewashing of this name. So Christian, you put up a Twitter poll. You asked the folks on the social side to do that, and you got some feedback.
We did indeed. And before I get the results of that poll to you, though, I just want to share some of the comments we received, because there were some interesting comments. First of all, Ben York Jones said Los Feliz, despite local verbal consensus, is how he prefers to pronounce it. Mark Andrada said, I went to Los Feliz Elementary in 1978 as a fifth grader, and both the kids and staff pronounce it exactly like it is in Spanish, Los Feliz. Kieran Murphy Gupta tweeted at Jose Feliciano, please weigh in.
Now, tell us who Jose Feliciano is, because I wasn't familiar with the name.
He's the guy. Feliz Navidad. Da, 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 da. That's Jose Feliciano. So the real Jose Feliciano, I assume, actually tweeted back, said, Los Feliz, of course.
I love that.
But Alexander Aquino says, I'm Los Feliz born and raised, but I'm open to change. Jose Hernandez said, it's Los Feliz if you're speaking English. English and Los Feliz if you're speaking Spanish. If I'm wrong, we should all start pronouncing Los Angeles as Los Angeles from now on.
So that's one that kind of irks me, because like Los Angeles is mispronounced, right? It's become a global thing and people know what it is, but I mean, it is wrong, quite frankly.
Well,
like,
there's no shortage of those around Los Angeles.
Absolutely.
And the greater LA area. Think of San Pedro, for example.
Which makes no sense to me. Every time I see that, I'm like, that's a very whitewashed version of that name, right? Yeah.
Marthy said Los Feliz, but I hate myself for it.
You should, Marthy.
Han Cholo agrees. He says Los Feliz is wrong, and you should feel bad. Signed, Spanish-speaking Latinos.
Everywhere. I can't speak on their behalf, but I'm sure that's true. No, it frustrates me because it's a very whitewashed version of this name, and it makes me. I always think about Roots when they changed his name to Kunta, from Kunta Kinte to Toby.
Well,
it
let's get to this Twitter poll result, because we got to move on.
Go ahead.
We had 946 people that voted in this poll, and the results, I have to say, were really surprising to me. Los Feliz got 47.9% of the vote. Los Feliz, 48.2% of the vote. So basically,
well within the margin.
It was a dead heat.
That's crazy to me. I appreciate it. I'm frustrated about this one, but I'm going to let you guys have this one.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Jared Hill, in for Steve Chiatakis, who will be back on Monday. However, before he left for some time off, he sat down with KCRW's Francis Anderton to discuss the late Ray Bradbury, a celebrated LA-based screenwriter who had an influence in Los Angeles's architecture and would be preparing to celebrate his centennial this weekend. Here's Steve.
Ray Bradbury used to say that he wanted to live to be 100. If he was still with us, he'd be celebrating that milestone this weekend on Saturday. He wasn't born in Los Angeles, but his family moved here when he was 14. He went to Los Angeles High School in Mid-City. He's an avid reader, movie fan. Even as a teenager, he started writing his own plays and short stories.
I cut my teeth at the age of 8 on Buck Rogers. I collected the comic strips. I happened upon Flash Gordon when I was 14. I fell in love with the novels of Edgar Rice Burroughs when I was 10. And out of this involvement with these books and these comic strips, there came a love which has lasted me for a good many years now.
That was Bradbury speaking at UCLA way back in 1964. Now, the love continued for many years after that, too. Of course, he grew to be a giant in the world of science fiction, but he also had a big impact here in his adopted city of LA, where his life will be celebrated on his centennial this weekend. And KCRW's Eric J. Lawrence, our DJ and librarian, and a big Ray Bradbury fan, by the way, he's with us right now. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Steve.
And Frances Anderton from KCRW's Design and Architecture Desk. When she heard that we were talking about Ray Bradbury, she said, you've got to talk about his influence in LA architecture. So she's jumping in on this interview as well. Frances, welcome.
Hello, Steve.
Eric, for people who don't already know about Ray Bradbury's work, where would you start them off? I mean, what book would you put in front of them and say, hey, you got to read this?
Well, the book that he wrote that probably still resonates as being one of the kind of important novels of the 20th century would be Fahrenheit 451, which he wrote in 1953. It was one of a handful of novels that he wrote. He was mostly, though, known as a short story writer. That's where he sort of made his bread and butter. And in fact, some of the novels, even something like Fahrenheit 451, was sort of what they call a fix-up novel made up of a couple of short stories that he just sort of tied together and made them sort of more marketable as a novel. But that clearly is his signature book. It's a book that's been made available once he got rights back to it from its original publication to have it be distributed as an ebook to anybody that had a library card free of charge. So he was obviously very proud of it as well.
He also loved the film industry, right? He got pretty deeply involved in Hollywood, too. I mean, here he was, right?
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things, you know, he grew up and had kind of an idyllic early childhood in a small town in Illinois. But when he moved to Los Angeles when he was 14, he was really excited about it because he was a huge movie fan. And this gave him an opportunity to sort of engage with the film community. In fact, he lived just blocks away from sort of one of the key theaters that would have regular weekly premieres. And he would occasionally ride his bike or even roller skate to some of those premieres. And he became actually well enough known to the community there that it sort of helped fuel his opportunities once he had sort of established himself as a writer to kind of get involved in participating in film. So, for example, like John Huston, the director John Huston, hired him to write the screenplay for his 1956 version of Moby Dick. And then in addition, of course, his own stories were adapted starting in the early days with radio programs, branching out into television. He had sort of a legendary episode of The Twilight Zone. He had multiple episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And then he did, you know, there were movie adaptations, things like Something Wicked This Way Comes and The Illustrated Man, and then later in on television, the miniseries The Martian Chronicles.
I want to play a little snippet from a short film based on his short story, and this one was called All Summer in a Day. I remember seeing this, by the way, when I was in junior high school, and it's about kids attending school on a very rainy planet, Venus, and they're excited at the prospect of seeing the sun, which only comes out every 7 years on Venus, only for 1 hour. And because there is no sun on Venus, the kids have to stand in front of a bunch of big lamps to give them the benefits of the sun, the light from the sun. The eldest child there in this group, Margot, is most excited because she's the only one born on Earth, and she says she remembers what it was like.
Can you hear it? It's letting up.
Listen. No, it's not. Besides, Mrs. Callahan put me in charge. She told me to make sure everyone goes under the lamps, and that includes you.
But the sun's coming out today.
So what?
So we don't need them.
Yes, we do. We always need them.
Well, not when we have the sun. Don't you know what the sun does?
Yes, I know what the sun does, but that doesn't mean that you don't have to go under the lamps just like everybody else. You think you're special just because you're born on Earth?
Those are the kids on the planet Venus. By the way, Eric, this was written in 1954. Venus is not a very rainy planet. It's a very hot and sunny planet. So, but I suspect in 1954 we didn't know a whole lot about Venus at that point. So we'll forgive Ray Bradbury for that.
I would say that he oftentimes did not refer to himself as a science fiction writer in the sense of writing about sort of hard science facts and putting a fictional story in it. He really considered himself more of a fantasist. And so even the books and stories that are set on other planets like that one, he didn't really intend anyone to truly believe that that was the way things were going to be on that particular planet. It just sort of gave him a venue to sort of have these speculative ideas about things that sort of reflect more earthbound issues.
You know, I said at the outset, Francis Anderton, that he was influential in L.A. architecture. Let's talk about that. How so? Where do we see his influence in L.A.?
Well, it may come as a surprise to you, Steve, but you see it in some of our better-known shopping centers. And I'll explain very quickly how. Yes. Ray Bradbury, at the same time as he was a futurist, he was taking us to other planets, he actually was very nostalgic in a way for kind of his small town past. He wrote an essay in 1970 for the Los Angeles Times in which he waxed nostalgic for a small town life where you had a community, where you met your friends at the theatre, the sweet shop, the drugstore fountain, where you didn't drive around in an anonymous metal box. And It was picked up by an architect named John Jurdy. John Jurdy, he passed, but he was famous for the design of the Los Angeles Olympics. He designed Horton Plaza, a very well-known shopping mall in downtown San Diego. He designed the Glendale Galleria. Now, when the Glendale Galleria opened, he wrote to Ray Bradbury and he told him, "You inspired this mall," because he had taken from Bradbury's essay this idea of somehow recreating the pleasures of small town life. I should add that in that LA Times essay, Ray Bradbury went on to talk about how the way you would recreate that thing that we had lost would be through the shopping center. He talked about a vast, dramatically planned city block, one for each of the 80 towns in LA. He talked about how that mall would have in it a bandstand, a stage, a plaza area where people would gather. It would have bookstores and cafes. And interestingly, later, John Jurdy and Ray Bradbury and a famed production designer, John DeQuier, who designed Cleopatra, Hello Dolly, The King and I, those three would meet for brainstorming sessions. In Bradbury's own words, they would blueprint cities, malls, museums. And this Ray Bradbury talked about, actually, in a foreword to a book about John Jurdy's work that I happened to edit back in the late 90s. Wow. And the influence, yeah, and the influence has lived on. You may remember, Steve, that just recently we talked about Hollywood and Highland. That's a mall at Hollywood and Highland that is getting its kind of third makeover. That mall, Ray Bradbury personally took credit for. He sat down with the original designers and he claims to have had the idea for the white elephants on columns evoking the movie Intolerance. He also was very passionate about...
Oh, the D.W. Griffith movie.
The D.W. Griffith movie. And Bradbury was very passionate about the idea of recreating in shopping malls the sense of being lost that you get when you're a tourist in a city you don't know. And he saw that to be a virtue of malls, is when you... They're a little bit confusing and perplexing to get around. And that was true of Horton Plaza and it was true of Hollywood and Highland. And to complete the thought in a kind of fascinating twist, the lead architect on Hollywood and Highland now is with a firm called Gensler. That man, David Glover, he used to work at John Jurdy, who I've just explained was deeply influenced by Ray Bradbury.
Bradbury lived, by the way, in the same home in Cheviot Hills for like 50 years, right? And after he died, Francis, a lot of people were not so happy when another L.A. architect, Tom Main, bought it and then tore that house down. Now, you talked with Main about that whole thing. What did he have to say about it?
Well, I have to say it caused a real sort of a scandal at the time within the planning and design and architecture world. This was a house that Tom Main actually unabashedly referred to as having an incredible unextraordinariness relative to the extraordinary nature of the writer. He called it then not just unextraordinary, but unusually banal. So he made no apologies for tearing down the house.
Yeah, unusually banal.
And now we will say that when Tom did this, the demolition sort of seemed to happen kind of overnight. You know, people in the preservation community were very upset. While they acknowledged that the house was a little yellow house that didn't necessarily have great architectural merit, there was definitely a claim that it had a huge cultural merit and how terrible it was that it had been torn down. However, to my knowledge, people in the preservation community had not previously applied for cultural or architecturally historic protections for the house. Now, as it happens, Tom and his wife Blythe Main, they went ahead and they have created in its place really a spectacular house, actually. But at the front of the house, they have this metal gate into which they have laser cut names of Ray Bradbury's books, as well as quotes from Ray Bradbury's books. And at the time when that little mini scandal unfolded, we reached out to a number of people to try and get a sense of what Ray Bradbury himself might have made of his house being torn down and replaced by a somewhat sort of futuristic house. And Jonathan Eller with the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University, he said at the time about Bradbury, he was intrigued by the greater and broader possibilities of experimentation. He even wrote a poem called "Fill Me with Wonder, You Architects, Make Me Wonder." So Tom would certainly argue that Bradbury would have been intrigued by what he built in place of Bradbury's house.
Well, on this occasion of his 100th birthday coming up this weekend, maybe you'll take a drive to downtown L.A., to the intersection of 5th and Flower Streets downtown, which is now Ray Bradbury Square. This happened, I think, back in 2012, that they actually dedicated that intersection to him as well. But obviously indelibly connected to Los Angeles for decades, Ray Bradbury, who would turn 100 this weekend. I want to thank you both, Francis Anderton from KCRW's Design and Architecture Desk, and EJL, Eric J. Lawrence, our DJ and a librarian as well. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
That does it for our show today. I'm Jared Hill. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you over the last couple of weeks. I'd love it if you check out my podcast that I co-host called Fanti. That's F-A-N-T-I. We discuss the complex and complicated relationships we have with our pop culture and our politics and celebrities. You can get it wherever you get your audio. It's called Fanti. On Monday, back in this seat will be Steve Chiatakis. Be well, as my mom would say, if you see someone without a smile, give them one of yours.